While flashbacks are to be avoided whenever possible, the flashback thought can be immensely useful in enriching both a character and a scene. In life, our thoughts interrupt us all the time. Frequently, the thoughts are relevant to where we are, what we're doing, what people are saying to us. Thoughts give texture to life and also to novels. The first three pages of my novel, Living Room, show the heroine, Shirley Hartman, locking the door of her apartment in a Manhattan high-rise, taking the elevator to the top floor and climbing the stairs to the roof. Then we get her thoughts, which are interspersed with thoughts of the past. Without those thoughts of the past as well as the present, the scene would lose impact. Let's join Shirley Hartman one page into the scene, listen to her thoughts, and then examine them closely to see how the effect is achieved. Through the gaps in the clouds drifting across the charcoal sky, she made out the moon. As a child, she could always decipher its face. Now it seemed to have only a scarred surface, crags and mottled ground where instruments had been implanted, sending messages even now. A few rectangles of light in the higher building across the street betrayed their occupants' sleeplessness. Shirley leaned over the waist-high parapet, her feet on tiptoe, and dizzyingly saw in the street below a taxi disgorging its passengers. Suddenly she thought of the unwashed dish with the remains of the cottage cheese and fruit. She should have rinsed it off, stuck it in the dishwasher, left things neat. And the diary she kept in her desk drawer, the leather flaking with age, the broken lock, the coded recordings of long ago, the first time she had taken pleasure with herself, the crazy evening with Harry. She should have dropped it in the incinerator. And Al's one letter. She should have flushed it away. Al, that intolerably independent man who could live without anyone, who she thought loved her but didn't need her. How would he react when he heard? Would it surprise him, the stoic who pretended never to be surprised by anything? Its tires screeching, the taxi accelerated away in the streets below. In the Times, she thought, her obituary would rate a picture. In the News, it might even make the upfront pages, given her occasional notoriety and the scandalous nature of what she was determined to do. Her father would think what? He'd say something like, "Death can't teach you anything you can use." In her mind, she touched fingers to Philip Hartman's eyes, closing them so that he could not see. Pulling herself up onto the ledge, she scratched her right knee. She remembered the midtown traffic accident she had come upon and the badly injured woman lying in the street, her dress up, her pubic hair visible to the gaping onlookers. Shirley was glad she was wearing pantyhose, as if it mattered. Why was she still holding her handbag? She dropped it to the roof behind her, heard the glass of her mirror break. What if her hurtling self hit that pedestrian late walking his dog? Or another one unseen? She was not a murderer. The only crime she wanted to commit was against herself. If there were a crowd below yelling, "Jump, jump, jump," would she leap into their midst? It seemed funny to be afraid to stand up on the ledge. She swung her legs around to let them dangle over the side. Would her limbs flail? Might her head turn down as she fell? The thought of it striking the pavement first was terrible. She stood on the parapet, swaying slightly. Al said she looked better naked than she did with clothes on, as if that were the ultimate compliment. Al had nothing to do with her decision. It was her life. She wanted out. Shirley held her breath. Mingled in Shirley's thoughts are the following flashback thoughts. 1. What she thought about the moon when she was a child. 2. The unwashed dish with the remains of her dinner. 3. The diary she should have burned. 4. Al, who loved her. 5. Her father. 6. A traffic accident with a badly injured woman. 7. Al's comments about how she looked naked. Why the flashback thoughts? If in the first chapter the reader saw an unknown woman trying to commit suicide, the reader's emotions would not be engaged in an important way. You have to know the people in the car before you see the crash. Shirley's flashback thoughts, added to her thoughts in the present, are how the reader gets to know Shirley and begins to want her not to jump. Note that the flashback thoughts are part of a visual scene in the present, a young woman up on a parapet ready to jump. If the flashback element is to consist of more than quick thoughts in an ongoing scene, the writer must be certain to create a flashback scene that stands on its own to avoid the flashback becoming a narrative of something happened elsewhere. To move from what is happening in the present to a scene from the past without breaking the reader's experience requires segueing to a scene in the past as inconspicuously as possible. The term segue is derived from music. It means to glide unobtrusively into something new. I prefer the segue into a flashback to the more direct method, moving from the present scene to a scene in the past inconspicuously. Flashbacks normally decrease suspense, but they can be fashioned to increase suspense. For instance, in The Best Revenge, there is a single scene that runs for 3 chapters. It is the fierce facing off of the protagonist Ben Riller and the antagonist Nick Minucci. To heighten the suspense of that confrontation, I inserted 3 flashbacks into the scene, remembered by Nick, designed to increase the suspense by postponing the outcome of the confrontation. Each of the flashbacks illuminates the long scene and adds to its meaning, and each is segued into and out of as surreptitiously as possible. In the course of the same novel, one learns a great deal more about the antagonist in flashbacks from his wife's point of view. We find out what kind of lover Nick is, why she married him, and what happened to the marriage. An antagonist, characterized in depth, has come to life as a credible human being, a person who holds the reader's interest, however inhumane his methods. Saul Bellow said that Nick Minucci, the villain, was the best character in the book. I believe Nick's flashbacks and those of his wife contributed to that view. If the ghost of Sinclair Lewis is within earshot, I say flashbacks done correctly can provide richness and depth to a novel, as long as they don't read like flashbacks, if they are active scenes slipped into and out of simply and quickly. If you have a flashback in your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, ask yourself, does the flashback reinforce the story in an important way? Is it absolutely essential? If it's not, you may not really need it. Can the reader see what's happening in your flashback? Can you give it the immediacy of a scene that takes place before the eye? If your flashback is not a scene, can you make it into an active scene as if it were in the present? Take a close look at the opening of your flashback. Is it immediately interesting or compelling? Is the reader's experience of your story enhanced by the flashback, or, however well written, does it still intrude? Has the flashback helped characterize in depth? Has it helped the reader feel what the character feels? Is there any way of getting background information across without resorting to a flashback? We now come to an ideal solution, moving flashback material into the foreground and eliminating the need for a flashback. The example I'll use brings forward childhood material, since that is the most common occasion for writing a flashback. You were a lousy kid, Tommy, a brat from the word go. Hey, man, if you got punished as often as I got punished, your old man was teaching you discipline. By yanking my plate away before I'd had a mouthful? He got through to you, didn't he? He starved me. What he got through to me was I was hungry and he wouldn't let me eat. I hated him. I wished he'd die. You got your wish, didn't you? In this brief exchange in the present, the reader gets the following information. 1. Tommy had a lousy childhood. 2. Whoever is talking to him thinks it was Tommy's fault. 3. Tommy's father withheld food from him as punishment. 4. The repeated punishments drove Tommy to hate his father and wish him dead. 5. The speaker is loading Tommy with guilt. Note that all 5 points were conveyed in short order without a flashback. You've just seen how information can be conveyed in present dialogue in such a way that the reader is witnessing a dramatic scene that takes place in the present, thus eliminating the need for a flashback. The example above is entirely in dialogue. Thoughts can accomplish the same purpose, as in the following example, in which only one of the characters is speaking, yet all the points are made. "What's bothering you?" Al asked. "You're not eating." Tommy poked his fork at the pork chop. He cut pieces off. He raised one toward his mouth, then suddenly put the fork down and shoved his plate away from him. "Hey, kid, tell me what's the matter," Al said. The matter, Tommy thought, was you didn't have my father. I did. You didn't have him yanking the plate away as punishment. You didn't go to bed with pain in your gut. "Hey," Al said, "is it your old man's death? Is that what's bothering you?" Tommy has said absolutely nothing. We've been privy to his thoughts. And we've got the background we need right in the foreground. In conclusion, I don't want to minimize the skill that's needed to make flashbacks as involving for the reader's experience as everything that happens in the present. However, I've never seen essential background material that couldn't be made to work as scenes, and more of that background can become foreground than you may suspect. The time it takes to do it right is an investment in the reader's experience. Chapter 15. The Keys to Credibility. Credibility is central to much of what the writer does. He creates a world in which the invented characters must seem as real as the people who surround us in life. What happens to them, however extraordinary, and it should be extraordinary, must be believable. The motivations of the characters should be credible, and that provides the occasion for the writer to meet his biggest enemy, himself. The writer has a natural tendency to act as we all do in life. That is, we question the motivations of others more often than we do our own. When creating fiction, those characters are ourselves, and we cover for them. This leads to a variety of problems. I have watched as a best-selling action novelist once again has a character throwing another character over the railing of a ship. Think a moment. How many people do you know who would be capable of lifting 150 pounds or more up from the ground high enough to toss that entire weight over a railing? In action fiction, the willing reader suspends disbelief. If one guy throws another over the railing, the reader goes with it. If a writer's concerned about the quality of his writing and needs to say that Tiny picked him up bodily and threw him over the railing, he will have planted earlier that Tiny is 6'3" and a weightlifter. In fiction, plays, and film, planting means preparing the ground for something that comes later, usually to make the later action credible. Planting is necessary when a later action might seem unconvincing to the reader. Not all actions require planting. For instance, if Todd trips Andrew and Andrew then punches Todd, Todd's action does need planting. Andrew's punch does not. In fiction that has a higher aim, the credibility of every important action in the story is at risk unless the writer is confident that the motivation or ability of the character makes the action credible. Some inadequate motivation is easy enough to fix. For instance, if a character suddenly gets up to go shopping for the convenience of the author because something is going to happen in a shopping mall, the events in the mall may not be credible unless the motivation for the character going to the mall is planted ahead of time. The planting can be simple enough through a touch of humor. "I'm not going to go on a shopping spree ever again, after today." Or you simply need to get a character out of the house. Instead of an unmotivated walk, he could say, "These new shoes are not going to get broken in if I sit around the house." Some actions are so bizarre that it may seem next to impossible to motivate them. We had been married for 3 years when, one Sunday, Tom dressed, as usual, in a shirt and tie, slipped into his handsome jacket, put on his best cordovan shoes, and left the house without his pants. What conclusion can the reader come to? That Tom suddenly went crazy? Or is this going to be a wacky comedy about an eccentric? Could Tom be so concerned about something else that he forgot to put on his pants? Readers are seldom interested in truly crazy people. It is hard to be moved by their actions because some seem so unmotivated. It is not credible that someone, otherwise all dressed up, would forget to put on his pants before leaving the house. We are left with the possibility that this is going to be a farce in which actions are not required to meet any tests of credibility. If this were a story about an eccentric who behaves unpredictably, Tom's strange conduct would require planting. If Thomas's action is not to seem ludicrous, he would have had to have been characterized as someone who could do something as zany as going out dressed up without his pants. Readers will not readily accept the unlikely. Can this character's action in going out without his pants be made to seem credible? Can Thomas's aberrant act be prepared for so that it will seem credible when it happens? Think of planting as preparing the ground in a garden. Tom and I had been married for 3 years when, one Sunday, he dressed as usual in a shirt and tie, put on a handsome suit and his best cordovan shoes, but forgot to put on his socks. I decided not to say anything, but the next Sunday he dressed in the same handsome suit, put on his socks before he put on his cordovan shoes, then tied his tie over his undershirt and left the house before I could catch him. I said nothing. But the third Sunday, he remembered to put on a shirt before putting on his tie, then put on a handsome jacket and left the house without his pants. I thought I'd better speak to him. This revision is funnier and more credible despite the zaniness of the action. Tom's forgetfulness was planted. The worst mistake that a story writer can make is to have unconvincing motivation for actions that are central to the story. A married engineer with a well-paying job notices a momentarily unattended carriage in a supermarket and kidnaps the baby. What is the reader to think? The reader has to guess. Is the engineer childless and desperate? Does his wife refuse to have a child? Still, kidnapping is a contemptible act for which the punishment is severe. What in the engineer's background would have made it possible for him to pick a stranger's child out of a carriage and take it away? How does the man's wife react when she learns of the kidnapping? When he is apprehended, what excuse does he give? There are too many unanswered questions, which makes the reader feel that this comes across as a made-up story, that the events described didn't happen. Clearly, the kidnapping of a child is a major action that must seem motivated at the time that it takes place. Coincidence is enchanting when it happens in life. A friend we haven't seen for years walks out of the same darkened movie house as we do. We go for coffee together and have a gabby reunion. If this happened in a story, the skeptical reader would say that the author is responsible for the coincidence and that it isn't believable. Here is an example of how to diminish the appearance of coincidence. Problem: Sally and Howie are ex-lovers who have not entirely gotten over each other. The author has arranged for Sally to run into Howie in the shopping mall. The reader smells coincidence. Solution: the reader learns that Sally has been avoiding a particular store she and Howie used to shop in because she's afraid of meeting Howie there. But Sally wants something that store and no other store in the neighborhood carries. Before entering the store's revolving door, Sally peers through the window to make sure Howie isn't in there. She goes in, finds what she wants, and hurries to the revolving door, a smile on her face, only to see Howie in the other compartment of the revolving door on his way in. They both register surprise, then laugh. A coincidence still? Yes, but the way the author arranged it with detail, the special store, Sally peering in to avoid Howie, the revolving door, all helped to make their coincidental meeting a true surprise. There are many other ways of diminishing coincidence. For instance, a third character can arrange for Sally and Howie to meet accidentally at an event staged by the third character. The most dangerous place for a coincidence to occur is at the climax of a story. The protagonist has his head on the chopping block. Suddenly, the Deus ex machina, the god in the machine, comes down for the rescue. Those devices fool no one. They exist for the author's convenience because he can't figure out a credible way of rescuing the protagonist. It is so difficult for a writer to gain objectivity about his own work, and in no area more so than in judging coincidental matters. I'd like to offer a peculiar strategy that seems to work. You can sometimes get objectivity artificially by making a new title page and replacing your name as author with the name of an author whose work you admire especially. Then read your manuscript with that author's eyes to see if you can catch any action that is insufficiently motivated or that smacks of coincidence. If that doesn't work for you, try preparing a new title page and replacing your name with the name of an author whose work you dislike. Go at the manuscript with a vengeance to root out unmotivated acts and coincidence. It's astonishing what a change of perspective will do. Above all, remember that the main actions of your work are like great flowering plants. Put the seed down well earlier and admire the harvest. Leave coincidence to the hacks and the God in his machine. Chapter 16. The Secret Snapshot Technique, Reaching for Hidden Treasure. The secret snapshot technique is designed to help writers whose fiction doesn't touch the emotion of readers, who write from the outside looking in, whose stories are uninteresting to experience because they seem made up. The characters and themes that lie hidden within each author are the source of work that strikes readers as original and real. How do we jog the author to write from the inside, in touch with subject matter and feelings that will enable him to brush the reader's emotions? I've used the secret snapshot method in individual conferences with writers and in seminars. In the latter, the author whose work is being discussed comes up front and sits in the hot seat. The two of us talk. Everyone else is eavesdropping. I ask the author to think of a snapshot of something so private he wouldn't carry it in his wallet because if he were in an accident, he wouldn't want a paramedic to find it. The snapshot we're looking for is one the writer wouldn't want his neighbor or closest friend to see, not even a family member, especially not a family member. I call them snapshots because I prefer that the writer start with something visual. Some people jump to the conclusion that a secret snapshot is of something sexual. Wrong. In practice, many are not. In one that worked for its author, her snapshot was of a rose in a one-flower vase that was put on her office desk by someone whose identity she never learned. In another, the author's snapshot was of an audience he addressed years ago. The image remained like grit in his memory, because all the while he talked, his undershorts kept slipping down. Later in this chapter, I convey in detail how a writer of detective stories turned her book around successfully by a snapshot of her 2-year-old sleeping in his bed. Some writers squirm through the process, shifting uncomfortably in their seats. That's a good sign. If your reaction to this exercise is, "My secrets are nobody's business," that's understandable. But if you want to write something that will move other people, you have to come to terms with the fact that the writer is by profession a squealer. He learns by starting to squeal on himself. If you're thinking that you may not have the courage to be a writer, I can tell you that's what most writers think when confronted with this assignment for the first time. Few people have the natural ability to open themselves up to strangers. The writer learns how. One of the ways is to write down what you see in your most secret snapshot. If you're tempted to fudge, don't. If you've decided to give us a made-up snapshot, you'll serve your writing better by changing it to the snapshot you're hiding. Nobody's going to see it. Not yet. Perhaps not ever. What they will see is the result of your finding the right snapshot. Is your snapshot such that any of your friends or neighbors might have one just like it? If so, change it to one that only you have. Your writing is going to be yours, not writing that could come out of anyone else's closet. Do you think other people would want to see what's in your snapshot if they heard what's in it? If not, you'd better try another. Please answer truthfully. Would you carry that snapshot in your wallet or purse? If your answer is yes, perhaps it's not so secret. The snapshots that work best are embarrassing, revelatory, or involve a strong and continuing stimulus to memory. If you're feeling, "Hey, I didn't bargain for this, all I wanted to do was write stories," I remind you that the best fiction reveals the hidden things we usually don't talk about. The stories and novels that get turned down are full of the things we talk about freely, the snapshots in your photo album that you show to friends, family, and neighbors. Readers don't want to see your photo album. They have their own. They want to see what's in the picture you're reluctant to show. You say, "Why can't I start with other people's secret snapshots?" You can. It's a longer route to success, but it gives you a chance to build your courage. A writer needs the courage to say what other people sometimes think but don't say, or don't allow themselves to think. If you elect to conjure up someone else's secret snapshot, it has to be one that you wouldn't be allowed to see under any circumstance. Can you describe that snapshot? What interests you in that picture? Would your interest be shared by lots of other people if the person involved were a character in your novel? If not, you'd better change the snapshot, or improve it. If you're stuck, try this. Everyone except liars has at least one person he truly dislikes, maybe even hates. What kind of snapshot would he carry that he wouldn't want you to see? Don't tell me the first thing that comes to mind, maybe the second. Would your enemy pay to keep you from seeing that snapshot? If not, try another that's really private. How much would you pay to see a snapshot from your actual enemy? Nothing? Not much? Then it's not a good snapshot. If you'd pay to see it, maybe people will pay to buy your book. Here's a snapshot you probably know. It's your best friend's secret snapshot. He or she may have confided in you about it. Or you may have guessed what it might be from a bit of evidence here and there, or because of your insight. While you're collecting other people's snapshots, how about one of someone you knew who is now dead? Does it make you feel safer? This method may seem a bit off-putting or uncomfortable at first, but experienced writers will tell you they love this exercise because they know how rewarding it can be. Probing secrets is a key to writing memorable fiction. A writer submitted for my consideration the early part of what she hoped would be a thriller about the hazardous work of a policewoman who works as a decoy, pretending to be a hooker in order to trap a killer. The students in the seminar liked the plot, but the story had not involved them emotionally. The author moved into the hot seat at the head of the table. The others all listened while I asked questions and she talked. It became evident that the writer had been on a police force, but no longer was because of something that had happened in her line of work. Interesting. But not as interesting as her revelation of what she felt was the worst moment of each day. It wasn't her hazardous work. It was when she tiptoed into the bedroom of her sleeping 2-year-old son to pat his hair before going off into the night to work. That was her secret snapshot. Hazardous conditions frighten us all. The possibility of premature death haunts our lives. The thought of not seeing a loved one again causes pain. And what love is as binding to a woman as her child, asleep in his innocence, his mother going off to a night's work from which she might not return? In that snapshot lay the emotional root of her book. After our session, the writer started her novel with a scene in which the decoy was patting the sleeping head of her child before going off to her hazardous work. As a result, the tone of the book changed from an ordinary, though suspenseful story told from the outside, to one readers could feel strongly. From that first scene, the reader wanted to say to the woman, "Watch out, be careful, come back to your child." With every danger the decoy faced, the reader thought of the sleeping child. The reader, full of emotion now, read the novel not as an interesting plot, but as a moving experience. Soldiers have to be brave. So do policemen, firemen, miners, and construction workers who walk on the skeletons of high-rise buildings. Test pilots have to be especially brave, because they are flying equipment that hasn't been flown before. Perhaps the bravest test pilots are the men and women who fly into outer space. They see the Earth differently than we do, as if they were people from another planet. Writers who do good work learn to see things with the innocence of visitors from outer space. Their bravest journeys take place when they fly into inner space, the unexplored recesses in which the secret snapshots of their friends and enemies, and their own, are stored. To provide your readers with insight, you become an explorer. That's what we've been doing here, exploring territory in your memory that has been, and continues to be, hidden from public view, but that can make your stories sing. Chapter 17. How to use all 6 of your senses. What a waste! In our daily work and play, our senses of sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell define the world for us. Then, as writers, we let three of our senses atrophy, as if our characters had lost part of their humanity and didn't need to touch, taste, and smell. Never mind that laymen neglect their senses. We writers have an obligation to use all five senses in our work if we are to enrich the layman's experience. Footnote. I urge every writer who wants to improve his sense awareness to study Diane Ackerman's extraordinary book, The Natural History of the Senses. And we cannot neglect the sixth that haunts our lives and our literature. I caution you, even the sense of sight, the one we use most in our life and work, needs to be honed beyond the everyday needs of the layman for whom we write. We need to see more acutely so that we can record what is fresh. We take our senses for granted. When we let their use atrophy, it often takes conscious effort and exercise to restore our awareness of the ways in which we take in the world around us. If you were to shut your eyes and remove your keys from a pocket or purse this moment, could you describe what a key feels like in a way that would be understood by a person who came from a country in which keys were not used? What have you observed or felt about your keys? If I handed keys to you, by what signs would you know that they were yours and not someone else's? Not knowing our keys from keys that are similar is symbolic of our neglect of our senses. We deprive ourselves and our readers. Most writers use sight and some conventional sounds and little else. This chapter, then, is a course in enrichment of your sensory awareness, and, through that awareness, an enrichment of your writing. Is the sound a cat makes spelled M-E-O-W or M-R-K-N-E-O-W? James Joyce, who had an acute ear, used M-R-K-N-E-O-W. Some people contend that the vocabulary of cats is extensive. There's no point to your using Joyce's sound or the cliché meow. Listen to your cat and see if you can't come up with something that your readers will recognize, but perhaps will never have seen in print before. Do we listen closely? Is the sound made by a baseball being hit thwack or crack or some other? There are clichés for most common sounds. I hope to persuade you to describe sounds not in clichés, but as you hear them after careful listening. Some of my students have come up with wonderfully original sounds that enhance their work. A young child at the piano, bonk, 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 or the whump of two automobiles coming together. Sound, of course, is not continuous. It is interrupted by pauses, by momentary silences, the absence of sound that makes music possible. Let's look at an extreme instance of the use of sound in Jerzy Kosinski's The Painted Bird. In it, you may recall, a 10-year-old boy who was abandoned by his parents in Europe during World War II wanders through a nightmare of savagery and love, in which he loses the ability to speak because, in speaking, he might give himself away. After the war, at the end of the book, a skiing accident lands the protagonist in the hospital, where something wonderful happens to his long silence. I was about to lie down when the phone rang. The nurse had already gone, but the phone rang insistently again and again. I pulled myself out of bed and walked to the table. I lifted up the receiver and heard a man's voice. I held the receiver to my ear, listening to his impatient words. Somewhere at the end of the wire there was someone, perhaps a man like myself, who wanted to talk with me. I had an overpowering desire to speak. Blood flooded my brain, and my eyeballs swelled for a moment, as though trying to pop out onto the floor. I opened my mouth and strained. Sounds crawled up my throat. Tense and concentrated, I started to arrange them into syllables and words. I distinctly heard them jumping out of me one after another, like peas from a split pod. I put the receiver aside, hardly believing it possible. I began to recite to myself words and sentences, snatches of Mitka's songs. The voice lost in a faraway village church had found me again and filled the whole room. I spoke loudly and incessantly, like the peasants, and then like the city folk, as fast as I could, enraptured by the sounds that were heavy with meaning, as wet snow is heavy with water, confirming to myself again and again and again that speech was now mine, and that it did not intend to escape through the door which opened onto the balcony. The universe of sound available to the writer extends from a simple bonk, bonk, bonk to Kaczynski's protagonist rediscovering his ability to speak. Humans see the world. Other animals smell it. Watch a cat investigating anything new, a surrounding, a possible food. It leads with its nose, just as its larger sisters in the jungle do. Cats and other animals define the world first by smell. In some human cultures, the sense of smell is treated as if it were an unwelcome adjunct to the good senses, fit only to be deodorized or perfumed. For the writer, the sense of smell provides opportunity. It is important not only to be aware of and use smells, but to be accurate in rendering them. Rubber bands have a marked odor. An old book smells musty. Unseen wind has a smell. If you don't smell anything, what might you smell? A single flower in an imagined vase on your desk? What he first noticed about Detroit, and therefore America, was the smell. That's the first sentence of a short story by Charles Baxter called The Disappeared, from the Michigan Quarterly Review. A writer can use the sense of smell to good effect in many ways, for instance, to help a reader experience a setting. I could tell we were coming to the kitchen. The odor of fresh baked bread drifted into the hallway like an invitation to follow where it led. Smell can be used to establish a relationship. Malcolm came through the back door, the football in the crook of his arm, his sweatshirt emblazoned with a dark butterfly of sweat. He put the football down and positioned his arms around me. I closed my eyes and could smell the earth of the playing field and what I had come to think of as the aroma of his presence. Characterization can benefit from the use of smell. Sally fluttered in, enveloped in her newest perfume. This tells us that Sally habitually uses too much perfume. Smell can also be used to establish atmosphere. Down and down we went. I stopped counting the stairs. The dank smell told me we were well below ground. Or this. Terry glanced skyward and sampled a lungful of chilled air. The universe smelled fresh, as if everything could now start over. The absence of smell is also useful to a writer. "They've bred the smell out of roses," Gloria said. "Don Juans are my favorite climbers because their touch is velvet and the rose breeders haven't robbed them of their smell. Yet." A gifted young woman named Ketty McCormick was briefly a student of mine some time after she had lost her sight. She still continued to see colors, not those in her field of vision, but those refractions of colors previously seen that remained inside her head. Her contact with the external world, like that of other blind people, was now mainly through the sense of touch, which most of us neglect. Ketty once had trusted her eyes to keep her out of danger. She had to develop a greater sense of trust in others that they would not leave things in her path that she might trip over. She was angry at males who left the toilet seat up. A blind person surmises how I might look by feeling my face. Try that sometime. Blindfold yourself and have someone brought into the room whom you haven't met before and who wouldn't mind if you found out what they looked like by touching his or her face. You might describe each feature, nose, cheeks, forehead, ears, chin, hair, and have someone write your descriptions down. Then, with the blindfold off, look closely at the person and at your description, and offer an apology for your probable inaccuracy. You are in all likelihood deficient in your use of the sense of touch, as we all are. It would benefit our writing greatly to improve how we see with the ends of our fingers. There's a way to do it, and you won't need a cooperative new acquaintance, just the blindfold, though it might help to have a friend or family member around to empty the contents of your purse or pocket on a table after you are blindfolded. Feel each object with your fingertips, describing it as best you can, as if to someone from another planet, who wouldn't know what those strange objects are that you carry everywhere you go. You can't say a credit card feels like plastic. You have to particularize. That exercise alone can work wonders in letting you experience your sense of touch. As soon as they came in from the cold, Eric reached into his pocket for a slim metal tube and brought it to his lips. He realized that he hadn't uncapped it even before he heard Sheila laugh. He pulled the cap off the tube, turned its base to bring the waxy plug up higher, and rubbed it across his top lip and then his bottom lip. In the example, the sense of touch fortifies the characterization of Eric as absent-minded, an improvement over the author intruding to tell the reader that. Does the handshake of an athlete feel the same as the handshake of a wimp? Does the hand of a child feel the same as the hand of a 70-year-old? Does the surface of every wooden chair feel the same? What does water feel like when it is too hot? What does your favorite cat or dog feel like when you are petting it? Would you dare write a love scene omitting the sense of touch? Your writing can only gain if you attempt to use the sense of touch at least once in every scene. That imaginary guest from another planet can also be useful to you in cultivating your ability to describe what you taste. Your guest has never experienced the kind of food you are eating. See if, from memory, you can describe in detail the foods that you tasted in the last meal you ate. Your guest has never heard of bran flakes or strawberries. You'll have to invent similes and metaphors to tell your guest what they taste like. It's not an easy exercise, but it will accelerate your skill as a sensuous writer. You wouldn't feed cardboard meals to guests. Don't feed cardboard meals to your characters. Make your reader's taste buds pop, even if he's from outer space. We speak of a sixth sense as a sensation we cannot identify with seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, or tasting, but which we know is there. It can be anything, imagined or real, a person or a higher power. Some people refer to the phenomenon as extrasensory perception, or ESP. A writer can make excellent use of a sixth sense in mainline fiction as well as in mystery and suspense fiction. You are alone in the house and you hear a door close. Is it the wind? But there is no wind inside the house. An exercise to develop your sixth sense is worth trying. Close your eyes. Imagine who is in the room with you. Turn all the lights on. There's no one here. Good, you can relax. Is your watch ticking louder than usual, or are you imagining it? Why is today different from other days? What is supposed to happen? Why isn't the phone ringing? If it does ring, who will it be? Close your eyes again. Are you sure someone isn't in the room with you? What if you're wrong? What if it's... It doesn't take much for you to feed your hungry imagination. Through practice, you can establish a link between your imagination and the so-called sixth sense. I've left the most important sense, sight, for last because it is the one least neglected by writers. Yet improving your eyesight, sharpening your ability to describe the visual, can be productive. The first thing you see is usually a cliché. We see the tall man, the attractive woman, the room full of people, the clean-cut lawn. These are the easy images that leap to mind. The writer's job is to look for distinguishing detail, the particularity in visualizing what his reader is to see. The man whose wavy hair wouldn't stay under his cap. The woman who looked ready to shout at just about anyone. The partygoers jammed together as if they were on a crowded subway train. The virgin lawn that looked as if it had never been walked upon. Ideally, the writer sees something that everybody will recognize, but that no one has quite seen that way before. A technique used too seldom involves changing the sense. Zalatnik led me into the shop not as if I was a fellow looking for a job, but as if I was a friend of a friend. I was sure the men in the shop could smell the difference. Smell isn't meant to be taken literally. Switching the sense from seeing to smelling creates a metaphor that gets the point across to the reader quickly. Here's how one might use each of the six senses to characterize players in a story. Gloria kept wrinkling her nose as if she were trying to sniff the truth of what everyone was saying to her. Smell. Greg knew that his handshake hurt people. Touch. On the phone, Mary's voice was like music. I couldn't hear the words, but I knew what she meant. Hearing. Lucille shielded her eyes like a make-believe Indian examining the horizon. Sight. Barry savored each spoonful of melon as if it were ambrosia he would never be allowed to taste again. Taste. Garrett could swear someone had come in behind him, yet hesitated to turn around for fear he would be right. Sixth sense. If you look at those examples again, you'll note that each of the characterizations is an action. Somebody is doing something. There's no need to stop a story to characterize or to use the senses. Chapter 18. Love Scene. The main concern of this chapter is the most common kind of love scene in literature, between a man and a woman. But there are other kinds of love that provide writers and readers with appealing stories. Love between an adult and a child. Same-sex love affairs. Love between a human and an animal. Love between children. And love in odd combinations. To begin with the last, we already know that a major source for writers of fiction involves bringing together people from different social or ethnic backgrounds who meet and fall in love. D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover and L.P. Hartley's The Go-Between are outstanding examples. In theater, the vitality of Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire is attributable in large measure to the clash of backgrounds. Sometimes the differences are bizarre. For instance, the love of a monstrously deformed person for a normal-appearing human, or vice versa. It is useful to study the classics, such as Beauty and the Beast and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, with an eye toward understanding how emotions are generated in the reader. The interplay in the audience's emotions may arise from the conflict of repugnance slowly overcome by affection. Young people are much more interested in and accepting of the grotesque in such fantasies. If you enter this difficult but rewarding territory, be mindful that your story, to be acceptable, must be sufficiently different from the well-known classics. Love stories of great poignancy can be fashioned out of the love between an adult and a child, because once upon a time everyone was a child. A child can be desperate for love. Adults are sometimes too busy with the mechanics of living, job, homemaking, the behavior of other adults, to respond to a child's need. The denial of a child's craving for affection touches many readers. Love between a parent and child, or unrequited love between a parent and a child in either direction, or the belated recognition of parental love or love of a parent, or a child or parent who rejects affection, all are possibilities. However, any sexual conduct involving a child raises the issue of child molestation, a different subject for fiction and one involving psychopathology rather than love. Affection between people and their pets or other animals is frequently the subject of children's books, and has long been important in such adult books as the Tarzan stories and Jack London's The Call of the Wild. It takes skill to make an animal believable as a character, and the best method is to give it a particularity just as you would a human character, a distinctive characteristic and preferably one that relates to the story, for instance, a cat that jumps up into the lap of everyone but the person who loves it. A mistake made easily in stories that involve animals is to neglect particularizing the human character. Also, it is important that the animal have a clear want of its own and not be merely the passive recipient of human wants. The writer who wants to write about the relationship of a human to an animal has to cross two tripwires. There seems to be a greater limit on imaginative story possibilities than in the relationships between humans. So much has to be done with human-animal material that innovation becomes difficult. Also, the trap of sentimentality is present and ready to snap. It may amuse you to know that George Stevens, a longtime editor of J.B. Lippincott, once a venerable American publishing firm, actually wrote a book that contained the three most common ingredients in the bestsellers of his time. He called his book Lincoln's Doctor's Dog. Same-sex love affairs have been the subject of fiction for a long time, though some books, like Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness, were often banned, and E.M. Forster's Maurice was not published until after the author died. During recent decades, homosexual love stories and homoerotic fiction have come out of the closet. A special market has developed for these stories, and homosexual attraction has made an occasional appearance in mainstream fiction. Infantile and child sexuality raises profound discomfort and disbelief in many readers, requiring great skill in the writing. However, a child showing immature affection for another child, sometimes called puppy love, is widely acceptable. This is not a frequent subject of fiction and is difficult to do well. Which leads us to the principal topic of this chapter, romantic and sexual love between adults. I have some bad news. Editors will tell you that love scenes are often among the worst written scenes, not only in rejected work but in published work. Such scenes are often mechanical, overly physiological, hackneyed, or sentimental. However, editors know that trying to discuss the flaws in love scenes with their authors is like walking across a minefield. One never knows when a flaw in the writing of a love scene derives from a buried discomfort in the author's life. In recent decades, we have had both a sexual revolution and a counter-revolution. Along about 1960, a prominent publishing attorney named Harriet Pilpel asked me if I was willing to go to jail for Henry Miller. I was then heading an upscale book club whose judges were interested in distributing a forthcoming Henry Miller title that dealt with sexual matters explicitly, and Miss Pilpel, well known as a civil libertarian, seemed quite certain there was then a real risk of allegedly criminal conduct in distributing works by Henry Miller that are today found in bookshops throughout the world. A few years later, the floodgates opened not only to books that treated sexual conduct openly and with some degree of seriousness, but also to transient novels that mocked adult lovemaking as much as misnamed adult movies did. Adults are in general knowledgeable about the physical apparatus and actions involved in lovemaking, and concentration on these can quickly become repetitive and boring. Some people, and consequently some writers, have never learned that mechanical description of sexual activity does not usually arouse readers who are no longer adolescents. Moreover, female readers, who account for the purchase of most hardcover fiction, often lose patience with male writers who continue to fabricate love scenes solely from a male point of view. Men who write love scenes as if they are dealing with the mechanical parts of an engine should know that such scenes have zero erotic effect and do not accomplish their primary mission of evoking a loving experience between people. Readers remain interested in passion, if not in the mechanical details. Moreover, any novel accrues an advantage by including a love story. It is one of the easiest relationships to plot, a fact that is most obvious in the field of musical comedy. A handsome young man appears at one side of the stage. A beautiful young woman appears on the other side. The audience immediately wants them to get together. It is the author's job to keep them apart as long as possible. The gestation of love can be the central dramatic event in the lives of characters. The loss of love is one of the most devastating things that can happen to a human being. Both possibilities can generate enormous emotion in life and, if skillfully handled, in fiction. The gain of love and the loss of love are powerful combustibles. It is doubly powerful to have both gain and loss of love in the same story. Suspense, tension, and conflict inhere in love stories. An endless cornucopia of relationships is available to the writer. Of course, disadvantages offset this. The prevalence of love in so much fiction requires the writer to exercise his imagination in order to come up with scenes that will seem fresh. Love stories also carry the danger of sentimentality. The writer invokes sentimentality when he elicits superficial emotions that are exaggerated, excessive, or affected, obviously designed to elicit the reader's sympathy. Sentimentality in fiction usually comes across as patently insincere, mawkish, or maudlin, and should be avoided. A writer's sensibility should be directed toward evoking a depth of feeling in the reader, not to fabricating superficial excesses of emotion on the page. The main flaw in most love scenes is similar to that of the main flaws in all other scenes. The reader's emotions have been insufficiently considered by the writer. The primary erogenous zone is in the head, and that's where the reader experiences writing. The reader wants to identify with a character. Love scenes can be especially effective when the reader is identifying with both characters, that is, with the hoped-for success of the relationship, experiencing more than each of the characters individually. This can be accomplished if the writer considers the love scene from the point of view of each of the characters, even when writing from the disciplined point of view of one of them. The reader needs to understand the relationship between the lovers better than either of the lovers do. The two most essential ingredients in love scenes are tension and tenderness. A crisis in the relationship or postponing lovemaking, keeping the lovers apart as long as credibility permits, generates tension. It's a mistake to let the reader know early the likely outcome of the scene. No love scene should be the repetition of a familiar ritual. To sustain the reader's interest in the outcome, the attraction should seem new, even in a long-standing relationship. Interruptions in a love scene can be useful. Not the grocery boy ringing the doorbell, but the lovers themselves noticing a picture, listening to some special music, talking about memories that arouse, all the while postponing the consummation to increase the tension of the scene. Literary foreplay does not necessarily involve physical contact. If the possibility of contact is in the air, nuances in actions and dialogue can affect the reader's emotions. A woman brushing her hair can have a powerful aphrodisiac effect. Less produces more in the reader. In the following example, a couple stand in front of the door of his house. The reader senses that once inside the house, they are going to make love. The writer's first temptation might be to let them in the house, to get on with it. But delay builds anticipation. It can be accomplished by minutiae. I was waiting for him to say something. Instead, he reached into his pocket and removed a key ring with three keys on it. Holding the first key, he said, "The garage." Then he held the second key, dangling the others, and said, "The back door." He must have seen me smile. He took the third key between his thumb and forefinger and said, "The front door." Then he handed the key ring with all three keys to me and said, "Welcome." Among the many advantages of a love scene is that it provides excellent opportunities for characterizing both partners and for creating sympathy or antipathy toward one of the characters. Love stories exist about each of the seven ages of man. Three of those ages are most useful to the writer. The youngest lovers may be inexperienced, tentative, nervous, worried about pregnancy, disease, getting caught. Any or all of these can become a writer's petri dish for brewing conflict and drama. External obstacles loom in abundance. The young lovers may be separated by distance because of school, work, and family. They may have to overcome class differences, family incompatibilities, peer pressure, or rivalry from another young person, or from an older, more experienced individual. Keep in mind that you don't want to tell the reader what they are feeling, but to evoke feelings in the reader as a result of what the young lovers say to each other and what they do. It helps to make each of them vulnerable in a different way. With adult lovers in the childbearing age group, one of the most powerful forces of nature is at work, the drive toward procreation, often unknown to or unacknowledged by lovers. The human race is perpetuated by drives that are endocrinal in origin. Romantic love, as it is experienced by most, but not all, people, is a cultural invention. While these are things that the average reader doesn't want to hear about, it is important that the writer know them. Footnote. As a guide to the probable sources of romantic love, I have recommended to many writers Helen Fisher's Anatomy of Love. Love scenes deal with the consequences of these physiological drives and cultural customs. Writers need to be knowledgeable about the nuances of human relationships and the origins of feelings. Hence, it helps for writers to know and understand as much as possible about the psychology and physiology underlying love, what the pulls are, whether or not the participants are aware of them. An obstacle commonly faced by adult lovers is the threat of a competing person and the consequent loss of security in a relationship. An adult wandering from a relationship can get involved with persons of questionable character and can blunder into acts of violence. The consequences of infidelity have inspired hundreds of plots. Some obstacles encountered by adult lovers are internal, such as guilt over conduct disapproved of by the person or by society. Also casting a shadow over both old and new relationships is the fear of passing age boundaries, of getting older. In plotting a love story, a writer must remind himself that plot grows out of character. What happens in a love scene should come out of the writer's understanding of his characters and their motivation, and the clash between such characteristics or motivation in different characters. Some basic questions to ask yourself about your prospective love story. Does each of your lovers have one thing that distinguishes his or her physical appearance from that of other people? Is there something distinctive in the way your lovers dress? Keep in mind that the most boring kind of relationship is one in which there are never any problems. He loved her and she loved him. They never quarreled, is the ultimate turnoff. In devising a love story, search for the root conflicts based on character and upbringing. Also ferret out surface conflict by asking yourself if you have depicted your adult lovers at a moment of crisis. If not, can you add a crisis that will increase the tension of the relationship? Does the woman want something reasonable that is refused by the man, perhaps for reasons that he keeps secret and that arouse her suspicions? Does the man want something that is refused by the woman because she is afraid of the result? Whatever your plan, remember that if there is no friction between the lovers, there is no interest on the part of the reader. And if there is massive friction, will the reader be convinced that they are nevertheless in love? If they are not, you don't have a love story. One exercise writers in my classes have found to be exceptionally beneficial is writing an exchange of 10 lines of dialogue, alternating between two lovers. The object is to have the reader experience two things from the 10 lines, that the characters are quarreling and that they are lovers, not ex-lovers. You might want to try your hand at the exercise yourself. You may use more than one line for each turn, but keep the exchanges short. Lovers quarrel in 10 brief exchanges. 10 lines alternating he and she. The lovers quarrel exercise is not easy. Some writers in their early attempts find it as difficult as rubbing the belly with one hand while patting the top of the head with the other. But that is precisely the kind of thing a writer must do in the best of scenes, have more than one thing going on at a time. Students have been known to revise and re-revise drafts of this short exercise week after week until they achieve the objective, having the reader feel that the characters are in love and are quarreling. Let's look at a bad example. He: where are you off to now? She: none of your business. He: you step out of this door, we're finished. She: I'm glad you noticed. He: noticed what? She: that we're finished, stupid. He: you're not taking my car. She: it's half mine, community property, now get out of my way. He: I'll report the car stolen. She: I'm sure the cops will love finding out you reported your car stolen by your wife. What's wrong? We have a quarrel, but no indication that, though married, they are still lovers. Let's look at another example. He: you touched me. She: I've got a license to touch. He: I just got home, hon. She: I know. He: hey, I haven't even had a chance to wash up. She: I know. He: I'll fall walking backwards. She: I know. He: the couch is in the way, hey! She: gotcha. It's clear that they're lovers. There is tension in the scene, but they are not really quarreling. The wife's repetition of "I know" is a nice touch, and the exchange has a coherence, but it is not a lover's quarrel. The point of this exercise is to learn how to do two things at the same time. When students develop their skill, I encourage them to add some narrative to the dialogue and even to increase the number of lines, if necessary, to complete the scene. The following mini-scene is what one of my male students came up with after some revision. "I never wanted to see you again."
"Then why did you come back?"
"The roses," he said. She turned in the archway, gilded by rays, back to him, walled, protected, and stared into the tangle of exploded flowers. They had opened and fallen back upon themselves like silent film stars, dried leaves, brittle branches.
"You came to see a dying garden, Ryan."
"We planted it together."
"I didn't know you were coming."
"Meg, I didn't know you would be here." She felt his eyes on her back. The Bukhara sucked in his footfalls as he crossed the room. He edged beside her. "It needs water, care."
"Maybe it will rain," she said.
"Can't count on rain. It needs some care."
"You were always too busy," Meg said, and slowly turned toward him. "It was beautiful once, wasn't it?"
"Like a meteor shower," Ryan said.
"I'm sorry."
"So am I." We know they are still lovers. At the outset, they are having a strong difference of opinion. The reader can't help feeling some emotion when reading this short scene. I encourage you to try this exercise from time to time as your skill develops. You may find a story or even an entire novel blossoming from it.